This is Vectis Radio. For the people, by the people.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and a very familiar voice that regular listeners will recognise, our very own Joe Plum.
Hello.
Hello, Joe. So, what's it like sitting on the other side of the desk?
It's a bit weird. I've got no buzzers or things in front of me to press.
You can play. You can pretend, can't you? Yeah. So, not only are you our very own DJ, hosting not one but two radio shows, The Political Soapbox and The Sunday Roast, you're also a teacher, actor, theatre producer and event director of the Isle of Wight Pride.
Yeah,
busy. Busy boy. So which of those hats do you most enjoy wearing?
It kind of rotates around a bit. It's whatever takes over quite often. I do love my teaching. That obviously I have to do for a day job, but for the last 2 weeks I've been on holiday, so I've not even really been thinking about it at all, which is quite nice.
2 weeks already?
2 weeks, yeah. I've still got another week to go. It's the private sector.
Oh, girl, amazing. Yawn. Nice.
So yeah, I enjoy doing the teaching stuff, but things like the theatre is something I've always been passionate about, and that's kind of my first love, really. Something I really enjoy doing, whether going to watch theatre, like I went to Jekyll and Hyde at Shankland Theatre yesterday, which was amazing and a really good experience. I love going to watch it, and I also love producing and performing in all different types of theatre. I did big comedy shows at Shankland Theatre last year, and I've done gritty modern versions of Shakespeare's Macbeth in the crypt of a church, you know, a whole contrast of different types and styles of performances, but I absolutely love it.
Yeah, so you're a bit of a Renaissance man, aren't you?
Yeah.
So going back to the teaching, you're at the Priory School at Whippingham?
Yeah, Priory School at Whippingham, currently the Year 6 teacher there, and teach all the junior school drama, and teach Year 6 English, and do a bit of politics as well. So all these kind of, all the different, many different things I do, they tend to collide with each other, with doing drama in school, doing drama outside, doing politics in school, doing politics at Vectis Radio as well. So I like to do, everything's kind of connected somehow.
Yeah, that's good though, isn't it? To kind of bring that real reality back into the classroom. And
yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And I love teaching politics to, like, 11, 12, 13, 14 year olds is amazing, because it's getting them engaged in politics from a young age, which I think is so important, because there's so many people who, you know, politics is all about making big decisions, and we've had referendums and we've had elections, and lots of people recently have been saying, you know, they just don't feel that they're informed and they don't know what they're wanting to do. And actually things like politics education, I think, is so important in helping people to know at least the process of what there is and the different sides of arguments, all of those things. It's I think it is really fundamental to helping young people make those decisions later on in life.
Oh gosh, I mean, we weren't taught politics. Well, I never did it, I never took it, because it was an option by the time we got to sixth form.
Yeah.
So we were completely ignorant, unless people have chosen to be informed themselves or had parents that were that way inclined. It's and yet it's such a massive thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it makes such a big difference to everybody's life, to the amount of taxes you pay, to your street cleaning, you know, everything.
Yeah.
And for us not to be talked about it at all. And you know, these things of, you know, never mention religion or politics at the dinner table. Well, no, we should be. We should be talking about this all the time. We should be arguing about it. We should be finding the holes in all of the arguments, and trying to actually say that, you know, this is the current system. Does it work? How could it be improved? What could we do? How would you change it? The more we do that, the more we get young people interested in politics, we get young people becoming politicians, and we get a country that's moving forward, which is really important.
Yeah, because I think it's, if I dare mention the B word, Brexit, I was totally uninformed, you know, I don't mind saying, and I think as a country, by and large, we were totally uninformed, and we went off and cast our votes, haven't got a clue really, you know. You might have thought, well, I understand a bit about what that side, the in or the out, stand for, and cast your vote accordingly, but I think there were limited number of people that knew the whole picture, because I don't think anybody could, because it's one of those things that will unravel later on, isn't it? But it's about being fully informed in order to make the right decision for you, isn't it?
Yeah, and in that referendum debate, that both sides wanted people just to be thinking about their heart, and they wanted to be going, do we emotionally want to be part of Europe, or do we not want to be part of Europe? Which is a rubbish argument, and they should both you know, be held to account for how they held that referendum campaign, because facts were not presented. And you have people like Michael Gove saying we don't need experts and all of that. You know, it was a really worrying time, because and people then are not informed because they're told whether you've got an emotional attachment to being in Europe. Do you feel like you want to be in Europe or do you not? And that's
it was
not
so much bigger
that
than that, wasn't it?
Be.
It yeah. was so much bigger. That it's not like, do you like chocolate cake or not?
No.
You know,
but that's how it was presented, and that's the worrying thing, I think, for many people now. Whether you're, you know, whatever side of the debate you're on, I think you're going to feel let down in terms of whatever happens with Brexit now, because of just the lack of information. But
yes, because it was all a bit retrospective in the end, isn't it?
Yeah, and whether, because I, you know, if you were really passionate about leaving, I think you'll probably feel let down that you've not actually left completely. And if you're passionate about remaining, then you're already feeling let down. It's just going to get worse. But it's one of those things. The public are just not going to be happy with it.
No.
And they're probably just waiting till everyone gets bored of it before they make the real decisions, which is the worrying time always in politics, is when people start getting bored of what they're talking about. That's when they creep in the dodgy things.
But indeed. And I was going to say, I think a lot of, and I'm generalising hideously here, but I think a lot of young people find politics boring, don't they? Because, like you say, it's always been, don't talk about it, and therefore you don't talk about it, therefore you don't know what you're talking about, you have no clue, so you keep quiet. And then if anybody does start spouting an opinion, they are just, they, you know, attention span, and they're very bored because they don't have anything you don't understand or have information on, you find quite boring, I think.
Yeah.
So it's getting people to feel passionate at a young age and get the, you know, get those kind of juices flowing for it and see it as something real and happening and really key and vital to their future lives.
Definitely, and it makes such a big difference and changes some fundamental things in our lives that people need to kind of get in there and realise that this is what's happening. Sometimes it is really boring. I've been to Rye town council meetings and they're the most boring things you can ever
do. And I'm sure there are other town council and meetings that are just as boring, Joe.
Well, I'm sure Rye probably tips the tops the list.
Dull.
But, you know, we've got council elections coming up, and at a local level, what the county council do, fundamental things that affect our daily lives, from bin collection to adult social care, like, all of those things come down to who you decide you want
That's
to be
right.
running your little area of the Isle of Wight. And some people will make a decision based on the party they see in front of them. Some people have no idea what names are ticking, and some people won't even vote at all.
Yeah, it's quite frightening, isn't it?
And that makes such a big difference to what's going to happen on the island.
And I think that apathy that creeps in, you know, at quite a young age, because I think, well, don't understand, or they're all as bad as each other, or whoever I vote for won't make any difference. It's that attitude that is quite toxic, I imagine.
Yeah, most definitely. It's worrying. Mm. And people need to need to get more information, and some parties for some parties it works in their favour that people feel that way, and they feel like, you know, we should leave it to the experts to carry on and do this. And actually, I think that people do need to have more information about this, and we need to share, and we need to be talking about it all the time.
So how, when you're teaching to such a young age, like you said, grassroots level, so I think you said 11-year-olds, is that right?
Yeah, 11, we teach civics.
So how do you personally manage to stay impartial and not let your own sort of views creep in when you're teaching?
Yeah, it's hard. It is hard. But what I try to do is play devil's advocate to everything. So they really have no idea what my views are, because I'll argue against whatever view they pose so that we can find the holes in the arguments. And just kind of take it on that we can have a debate about anything, and I'll sway from one side to the other. And I think the more fluid you get it, the easier it is for them not to say. Because actually, it doesn't matter what. You can argue whether you think we should get rid of homework, for example, as a starting point.
I can argue
one way or another, and actually not be necessarily about my own opinion on the subject. And once they start to realise that you don't have to be fundamentally, like, I am opposed to all homework, or I believe in all this. It's not the polars. There's a whole spectre of different opinions within there. And once you start tapping into that, it makes it a lot easier for us, I think.
Yeah, just I was, you know, that debate that came up again very recently about taking children out of school in order to enable them to go on a sort of cheaper family holiday. What was your view on that?
Yeah, I I think that I mean, within there, there are some key arguments about the way that schools manage attendance, and I think that we need to look at. But I don't think there are so many holidays in the year, and I know it gets more expensive, but you shouldn't be taking that out on on teaching staff and saying, I want to be able to take my child out of term time. No, go and attack the holiday companies, yes, and go and say, yes, this is what's... It's not the school's fault that the prices are more expensive. You know, and if you can't afford to go to Florida at that time, then go and take your child to Skegness or somewhere.
The
Isle of Wight. Go on a nice holiday and go at the times that have been allocated. You've got so much holiday time that you can do that, and you should be going out and having a nice time then. And then school, we got the pressures on teachers to get grades and get them through lessons and get them through the topics to get to their GCSEs or their SATs or whatever is so high that as soon as you mess around with attendance, it is directly related to attainment. So as soon as you take the child out of school, they cannot learn what you've been teaching the rest of the class, and they will fall behind, whatever reason. So we should be promoting attendance rather than saying, oh, I want to take my kid off for a holiday now. And I know there are some benefits to going out and exploring the world, but really, like, sunning yourself on a beach in Florida is slightly different to a...
archaeological
trekking somewhere else where you're exploring the environment and analysing bird calls or whatever. There is a big difference in those kind of types of education. I think that's got a bit lost in this argument, but
I think it is a shame that the travel companies don't come to heel a little bit on this one. I know it's a great opportunity for them to make stinking more loads of money, but it's such a hot topic, isn't it? And why not bend a little bit? You know, they are making money on the backs of parents that are probably, you know, quite strapped for cash anyway.
Yeah, I do. Although I have kind of bashed the holiday companies there a bit, I think, especially people on the island and the tourist trade on the island, they are giving rock bottom prices during term time just to keep going. And it's the holiday money that the prices do go up, but that's what keeps it surviving, and that's what keeps those tourist industries going. So it's a difficult balance, isn't it? We shouldn't be punishing kids for taking out we shouldn't be punishing parents taking the kids during holiday time, but at the same time, that we shouldn't also be punishing the travel companies who need to make money, and it is a benefit to us.
There you are. You see a very even-handed argument from you there, Joe.
Yeah, chaos. Yeah.
You've gone straight into that grey area there. No, it's a tough one, isn't it? But I think playing catch-up, especially, you know, with young kids, it's hard, isn't it, when they've got a...
Yeah.
And it's hard when the teachers are then expected, you know, and parents are saying, so what did you do in the last 2 weeks then? Can I have notes? And it doesn't work like that, really, does it?
No, not at all. You've got that. It's a whole, like learning experience is a kind of stupid phrase, but it is that everyone in that class has experienced. You know, go through, whether it's algebra or something, you go through it together, and as soon as you've then got to take somebody out of that process, they haven't been on that journey to get to that point, it then, you know, having to redo it and rejig it, it's a challenge, and it's difficult enough to catch up when people are genuinely off sick or whatever.
Yes.
And to bung a 2 week holiday on top of that is it makes the job very difficult.
Yes, I can see that. And having been into your school and done a little bit of work and some reading and you know, doing a novel writing thing, wasn't it, we were doing?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was fun. And it's just the delightful environment in which you work and the children learn, because it reminded me going back to my old school days, which, of course, is eons ago, and it's the tiny wooden desks with the, I think they've got the pencil ledge, haven't they, and the inkwell.
Yeah.
It's just lovely, and they all stand up when you come into the room and put their blazers on. It's just amazing. It's really going back in time, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And they've kind of...
In a good way.
The Victorian school and the kind of the desks and the quaintness of that, it is really lovely, and it adds an extra touch to it. And I think the students kind of take pride in the fact that they're in that kind of environment, and it is a really nice place to be. And there are some... And what I really like about it is, and this is something that was mentioned when we did the youth hustings at Ventnor Exchange, was teachers should be able to teach how they want to teach. And I think... especially, you know, being in the independent sector, you get that more of that opportunity. It's creeping in the kind of Ofsted prescribed, you must have this, 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 which is sad, because actually teachers teach in completely different ways to completely different kids and should be allowed to teach, you know, in whatever way best suits them and best suits the children you've got in front of you. And I think the environment that was set up at Priory means that you can do that, and I hope that, you know, in the future we can keep going like that. And actually, I think kind of a response to what's happened with Ofsted at the moment will be that hopefully that teachers will be given more autonomy to teach how they want to teach and get the best out of the learners that are in front of them. Not
surely, as long as you're achieving the results that the children need and want, and that's the end game, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's exactly how it should be. Mm. It's the but when they start saying, you know, you must have this at the beginning of your lesson, I want to walk into every... I was looking around lots of schools recently. Went to one, and the head teacher said, you know, I want to walk into a classroom and I want to see this, 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 this. And I was like, I don't want to work here then, because why would you want every classroom to be exactly the same? No kids are exactly the same. Everyone learns in different ways, and that should be the way that we're working. But we'll see. That's my teaching rant.
No, but I think justified be so, because it's almost like the tail wagging the dog, it seems to me. It seems like something's gone slightly awry and it's gone a bit out of hand. I know obviously they were trying to raise standards initially when it was all set up, but it seems to me a bit dictatorial now. And most like definitely. You say, there's no... you were talking about the heart earlier. There doesn't seem to be any heart in it. It seems to be very prescriptive and not necessary, and one size fits all, which to me is never a good idea in anything in life.
No. And it is upsetting when you see that. And I can see, like, there are problems, especially on the island, with education that needed to be sorted out. And I think what the kind of has come out of that is this extreme, like, bam, 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 every classroom must look like this. This is how you should be teaching. One size fits all kind of thing. And it just doesn't work. And you've got that on one side and this kind of weighing the pig to see if it gets fatter, constantly checking up without that support underneath. And you've got both of these things going on at the same time. And that's why half of teachers who student teachers who join the profession, half of them leave within their first year of training, and then half of the half that have remained leave within the first 5 years. And it's because of this, because they're not being given the opportunity to be able to go out and teach how they would like to teach and get the best out of their learners. And they're constantly being checked up on.
Sorry, given this huge drop-off, so these teachers have been trained, obviously, which has cost money, cost their time, and so they're highly trained, but there's this big drop-off. Why isn't someone somewhere learning from that and thinking, well, this clearly isn't working for the teachers, so we've got to change the way we do this?
That's what should be happening, but it's not. And there is a big sea change, and you can start to see a lot of people talking about this whole thing that we need to let teachers teach how they want to teach. And I'm hoping that that's what they'll do. But at the moment, they're just thinking, right, nope. These teachers who are dropping out are just people who aren't strong enough to be teaching in the way that we're doing.
Yes, and it's
that argument rather than the...
But you could be losing some real gems, couldn't you?
Yeah, most definitely, yeah.
People, from my knowledge, they go into teaching because they love children, they love passing on their knowledge, and that's where they kind of get their kicks. Not from the admin, not in all this, being checked up on all the time. And it just sounds hideous. I wouldn't want to work like that.
Yeah, it's put so many people off teaching, and the people who leave, there are some who just teaching isn't for them. And that's perfectly fine. You can understand that someone can do teacher training and then realise that being in front of a classroom full of 30 screaming teenagers is not a world you want to be in.
Yeah.
For other people who are amazing teachers, they get so fed up with the system that they're like, no, I'm not going to buy into this anymore. I can go off and, earn more money, spend less time, because teachers are one of the most overtime of any other job. And they can go, right, I can actually do 9 to 5 hours, I can go somewhere else, get paid more, and it'd be stress-free. It might not be as exciting and engaging as teaching can be sometimes, because when teaching is good, it's amazing, and it's really, really good. But when teaching is bad, it's really, really, really bad.
So what's been your... It's a difficult question, I'm sure there's so many, but what's been one of your golden moments in teaching? So I am so glad I got up this morning and came in and did this, because look at the difference I've made.
Yeah, there are some... I've got kind of... there are some lessons that I kind of keep in my back pocket of like, I know these are really good lessons.
I love that. It's brilliant. Yeah.
And there are. And there's one, my favourite one, which actually I made for when I did my job interview at Priory, was all about reading comprehension, and it's a murder mystery lesson. So you've got lots of different types of resources. And I've done it with every English class I've taught there. And it is great fun because the answer is staring them in the face the whole entire time. But you see them go for it, and they always go for it. And it is really, really interesting. And I just love that lesson because of the kind of engagement and excitement that they do. And then there's something like, oh, for goodness sake, at the end of it. And it, that is good fun. And that's, and sometimes you watch kids, and there are sometimes where I go, I have sat through, and when I taught at Carisma, I was doing lots of drama. I head of drama over there, and I was doing watching a lot of drama performances, and I'd say to the music teacher, I've just spent like 40 hours watching terrible drama. And then suddenly someone will do something amazing, and they do a fantastic piece, and that's what I quite like about it. There is some the tree acting and other things like that, and you think, oh, why doing this, why am I seeing through? And then occasionally you get some real gems come through, which is lovely.
Yes, and when you've had some sort of, you've affected that in some way, that's the buzz, isn't it?
Yeah, and there were those kids who absolutely hate school and hate everything else, and for them drama is a subject that they can actually engage with, because they don't have to do much writing, they don't have to sit behind a desk, they can run around and they can do things and they can be somewhere else that isn't them for a little bit of that day, and for those people it's really special, and that's why drama and arts education is so important. And at the moment we're seeing that get cut back, we're seeing, you know, this all those subjects are the first to go when it comes to redundancies, etc. And it's such a shame, because those are the ones that engage some of these people who are the ones who really need it more than anything else.
Yeah, because I was seeing something today on social media about the mental health of our sort of teenagers, you know, the secondary school age, and how they're really struggling to be heard and to make these problems and these issues they have understood, and sort of crying out into the wilderness, really. And I suppose drama is one way, like you say, to perhaps work through some of these issues, or maybe at least bring them to somebody's attention.
Yeah.
In a almost like a covert way, if they're not comfortable talking directly. But that's worrying, isn't it? I mean, you know, obviously I know you're teaching younger ones, but it must be hard to see that and not be, I don't know, it's I think it's far more prevalent now, for example, than when I was at school, but maybe we've just bottled it all up, I don't know.
Yeah. When and it is worrying around redundancies in schools that the first lot to go are subjects like the arts and support staff who are doing an amazing job at that counselling,
kind of like pastoral care,
yeah. And that's the side that are the first to get the chop whenever you are making redundancies in schools. They're some of the most fundamentally important people in young people's lives. That for some people, some young people coming to school, and you find out what it's like at home, and you see this kind of as being like a sanctuary for them, a kind of a happy place that they can go and learn and enjoy, because they've had the support from that, from those support teams, those people who are getting them into school each day, who are putting a smile on their face, and they're the first to go when it comes to redundancies. And that really worries me, that we're just going to go to this, like, sat behind desks doing English and maths, and that's it. And for a whole load of people, young people, that's the thing that completely turns them off education. And without that core education, then it doesn't set them up for a positive life post whenever they leave school.
Yeah, and a lot of them that do feel they sort of almost duty bound, I think some of them feel they've got to go on to further education, and they work incredibly hard and put themselves under enormous pressure. That's another thing, they all seem to put themselves under huge amounts of pressure to get to, you know, fulfill their goals, and then again that problem seems to be very prevalent in universities and colleges, where people have young people have a lot of mental health issues, which seems so sad. And there's think it's far more rife than we're led to believe and that we're aware of.
Yeah, definitely. And those young people going into and the pressures of getting people into university who aren't necessarily suited to university life or ready for it, really. There's, you know, it's not for everybody, and it kind of, the pressure is on so much on teachers to go, you know, you will be rewarded if you get this X number of students to university. That's what we want to be seeing, that's what we want to be doing. And it's like that factory of, like, right, come through school, go, off you go to university, and just, especially people on the island, it's a big leap to go to the mainland,
yes,
to go quite far away. And however, you know, even if you go to Southampton or Portsmouth, there's still a, it's still a journey to get here.
Mm, very much.
It's still difficult for some people, and that mentally can be really worrying for some people. And I think, and I, you know, I've sat in staff room in when kids are doing their GCSEs or their A-levels, you've got teachers panicking and crying in the corner of the room because their kids, they've just, like, had a glance at what's in the GCSE paper. You think, why are we getting teachers in such a state at the fact that before their A-levels or GCSEs, just more worried than the kids are?
Exactly. Sometimes. And if that's the effect it's having on the teachers, then no wonder the poor kids are beside themselves.
Yeah,
and then
it's so worrying.
Yes, the more, I used to lecture at university, and I saw a small amount myself, but I'm hearing far more sort of under the wire now. And it just worries me that it's not out there, that it's not being talked about. So I think it's very important to bring it out there, and something really does need to be done. It shouldn't be swept under the carpet and universities kind of not holding their hands up to perhaps, you know, these issues. I think they should do something about it, because it's a time bomb, isn't it, waiting to go off. So after the break, we're going to be back with Joe, and I think shall we talk about things all actorial and theatre?
Yes,
darling, lovely.
Darling.
I think that'd be marvellous. Yes. So thank you very much for listening. Please join us. Don't go away. Have a hot cross bun and come back, and maybe follow us on Twitter in the break at Vectors Radio and Facebook, and check out the Vectors Radio Training School if you want a career in broadcasting. It's a great in, or you just want to up your confidence levels, and it's a for young people, and it's at www.4ps.org.uk, and it's completely free, so check that one out, because you might just enjoy that. Okay, listen back after the break. Thank you.
Stay social and get in touch. It's at Vectors Radio on Twitter. The World Wide Web never felt so local.
This show is sponsored by the new Rembrandt Gallery, professional bespoke picture framers. We undertake all types of framing work. Visit us in person at 15 Scarrett's Lane, call us on 01983 529 285 or Facebook the new Rembrandt Gallery.
Hello and welcome back to Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and our very own Joe Plum. Welcome back, Joe.
Thank you.
And before the break, we were talking about politics and teaching, and we thought we'd have a bit more fun in the second half, yeah, and talk about things actuary. So, where did you train? What did you do? How did that dream come alive for you?
Well, I've always sort of been involved in theatre. I really liked drama at school, did lots of work on that, and throughout GCSE and A-level, and knew that that's the area I kind of wanted to go into. And did lots of theatre outside when I used to go to church when I was younger. I always used to do plays and drama and there. And then went to Stagecoach for a bit in Shanklin, and then went to Red Tie with Helen Redding for a lot of kind of my teenage years. And then I went to London South Bank University and did theatre producing, which was amazing, an amazing experience to be up in London.
So theatre producing rather than being on the other side and being and
yeah, so
performing.
It was a bit like a jack of all trades, really, in terms of that, how to run and create a production, which I think was a really, really good course in teaching you every different aspect of that. So we did. Our second year was at the National Theatre. We did a lot of work at the National Theatre Studio with the archive department, looking back at past productions, and then created a piece of work inspired by some stuff. So we did Shakespeare's Titus Andronicus at the National Theatre Studio, which was great to do. Completely mental, as was most of my plays. And then we did Frankenstein, which is inspired by the National Theatre's production of Frankenstein with Benedict Cumberbatch, Johnny Lee Miller, directed by Danny Boyle, which we did a lot of work on that production. And we had Billy Pothelswaite, who's Pete Pothelswaite's son. He was in a show at the National at the same time and did our Frankenstein, which was, I still think, one of the best things I've ever done. It was a really fantastic piece and just inspired by so much. We directed Colin Ford in Crap's Arse Tape by Samuel Beckett, which is a fantastic play, one-man show where he spends the first 15 minutes not talking and peels a banana and eats it, is essentially all that happens in the beginning.
Right.
And then he listens back to all of his previous recordings, so he records all, like, his diary entries. He's using this to go through the tapes and listening to all the recordings. So kind of use that as a starting point for how we did our Frankenstein. So we had Frankenstein at the moment, he's about to bring the monster to life. You have this monster in this giant scaffolding tower, already chained up and ready to go, and then Frankenstein looking back through his video diaries of the different stages in making the monster to decide whether or not to switch the button and turn it on. So it was kind of it was a fantastic production. I went to the
were you front of house, or where were you in that?
I wrote and co-directed so that production, and my favourite moment was getting, I was living down here and commuting up to London in my third year, so I went to Hamilton's Butchers, one of our sponsors. Lovely.
Indeed.
People. And I asked them for a heart and some lungs and things. And then I carried them up in a big ice box up to London, which absolutely
I bet
stank.
You were popular on that train, and, yes.
Which was very funny. So I enjoyed doing that. And
Did you have some fun with it? Please tell me you had some fun.
Oh, yeah. It was pokes and all sorts of things were involved in that horrible thing by the end of the week.
Yes. But I was thinking more on the journey, you know, kind of just...
Yeah. I should have just...
Your fellow passengers, winding them up.
Grabbed it, moved it around.
Yeah.
That was a really interesting production. I really enjoyed doing that and working on it and working with the National to create it, and all sorts of experiences I had up in London, just to be able to go. A lot of my friends took the mick out of me because I'd always choose, I had a choice of food or theatre. So do I go to the theatre tonight or do I eat for the rest of the week?
I see, yeah.
Go to the theatre. It was always the answer, and just saw a phenomenal amount of a whole host of different productions and amazing people delivering amazing performances in London over that time, and I just was so lucky to be able to take all that in and experience all it.
I think there's really very little that compares to going to theatre and seeing those, like you say, those names doing their best work, you know, and having seen Maggie Smith yonks ago in Letters and Lovage with Francis de la Tour and Vanessa Redgrave, you think, I was there, it was wonderful.
Yeah.
And at the weekend I went to see Imelda Staunton in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Brilliant, yeah.
I turned up at the National and the guy on the ticket box, he says, not one of our productions, you know, I think you find that's the Pinter. Right. So, first time I've ever done that, but anyway, forwarded a very nice walk through through town to get there. Luckily, he'd left enough time. But just incredible performance, you know, I mean, as always with Imelda Staunton. And she's just tiny, but she's this huge powerhouse of talent, isn't she? And she just brought the whole thing alive. And it was 3 hours. And I did think, you know, with my pea-sized brain and Nat's attention span, would I be able to sustain it? But you do, you know, and you don't want it to end.
Yeah.
It's just, you're not looking at your watch thinking, oh, I've got to get out of here. You just think, this is fantastic. And I invited a friend. I said, would you like to come and see it? You know, I'll buy you a ticket. No, she said, I'd rather stick pins in my eyes, because she didn't like all what she thought was going to be kind of shouty, argumenty stuff in the play.
Yeah.
And obviously it's a spiralling middle-class, middle-aged marriage that, is, for the most part, is going down the toilet. But the joyful lines and the way in which they're delivered is very funny. And people were just roaring with laughter. And the ending, it is strange and uplifting. Have you seen it?
No, I've not.
It's a real treat. Honestly, you will just love it. And it was Saturday afternoon matinee, absolutely packed. And you think, good, it should be packed.
Mm.
You know, they deserve. They've spent all that time learning all those lines, for heaven's sake. You know, 3 hours worth of lines. How do they do it? I certainly couldn't. And at the end, I'm usually the only one on my feet, kind of applauding like a lunatic. But on Saturday, the whole of the audience were on their feet. And I thought, yeah, absolutely, you deserve. I don't know. I mean, you're an actor. You get up there. It's such a big part, isn't it, of the performance, is to take that applause at the end.
Yeah. I think it's throughout the whole thing, though. You've got that interaction with the audience doesn't just, erupt at the end
no.
of the applause. That actually, throughout, and you feel, and you hear a lot of actors go like, oh, is it a good night tonight? Oh, it's very quiet out there tonight, la 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 la. Even when you're doing plays that the audience are deadly silent all the way through, some serious, gripping thriller or something, that you hardly get any kind of any noise from the audience, but you can tell straight away what kind of audience they are. And they're so mixed, and it, you know, the one person with a very loud laugh can transform a whole night.
Or, absolutely.
Yes. And all those things. But we did One Man, Two Governors at Shanklin in the summer, and we brought it back in the autumn as well. And that's such great fun, because my character was interacting with the audience all the time, so you're constantly like looking at, seeing them and picking on them and bringing audience members up onto the stage. But it is just when you've got a good strong relationship with the audience, it completely transforms what you're doing and the play you're doing.
Physical play, isn't it?
Yeah,
because it's complete farce. Ridiculous. And yeah. was it your character that runs kind of to and fro the whole time and just burns up heaps of energy? And
definitely, yeah. My favourite scene in it is there's a food scene, and essentially you've got two doors, and I've got two masters, and the two bosses can't know that I'm working for both
at
the same
time. Yeah.
So I am running between the doors to ensure that that door is never open when that door is open, and all of that is happening constantly. Plus a doddery old waiter it's his first day and he's 84 and he is pulling everything away. He's got pacemaker and all sorts of silliness, and we're all trying to lay it all out. Plus I'm incredibly hungry, so I'm trying to eat as much as I possibly can, and get to eat 12 chicken balls every night, which is a highlight. And that kind of chaos and silliness, and it was so much fun. But you are full on running from one end of the stage to the other. My shirt was always drenched at the interval. But
I assume you would be, because I saw it with James Corden in the West End.
So
I should assume you're playing
James
that character.
James Corden as well, yeah, Francis Central.
And he lost tons of weight, didn't he? Which was no surprise.
I didn't lose any, so that's...
Perhaps he didn't have the chicken balls.
No, it is a really good... It was a good workout, basically. And some brilliant moments, like having a fight with myself on stage. There's a number of big monologues in this, and one of them is that whole, he just has a big argument with himself and a big fight and rolling all over the floor and punching himself and all sorts of things. It's just, we worked very hard on those kind of big physical movement scenes, and they, I think, came across really well. It was such good fun to do and such a strong cast to work with. I absolutely loved it.
Yeah, but you've just got to be so quick-minded and witty, haven't you? You've really got to be on it on that one. You can't just have an off night. You've got to know what you're doing.
Yeah, I'm not very good at learning lines.
So how did you overcome that then?
You get the gist of the players. No,
bit of improvisation.
There's quite a lot of improvisation. But it's just hard to keep it all in. But I had to know the whole play. I did. We did Pygmalion a few years ago. The play that My Fair Lady is based on, and that's was Henry Higgins, and didn't come off stage the whole entire time. So you just have to learn the whole play and learn everything, and then you just slot in your lines every now and then. But I knew that there couldn't be a moment where I didn't know what I was doing, so I just had to learn the whole entire thing, and that was quite easy actually, to know I had that big thing to learn. Whereas One Man, Two Governors is a lot of very complicated things, but you've got to get all the names right and everything right. And
yes. You've got to have your mark. You've got to whiz from... You've got to be in the right place at the right time. And it's fast and furious, isn't it?
Yeah. But you learn that as sort of choreography and how that moves and how you run around. But it is tricky. But that's part of the fun of it. Like, it's... I always say that there's no point doing it if it's not fun in anything I do, whether it's teaching, whether it's the theatre stuff, whether it's political debate, whatever it is, that if it's not an enjoyable experience to do, it doesn't matter how good it is at the end, then it's not worth it. And it should be, that whole process should be enjoyable. And that was for One Man, Two Governors, and it has been for so many of the plays I've done. That's
a very, you know, I mean, that's a brilliant philosophy to live your life by. Do you think a lot of people think, well, that would be nice, but I kind of have to earn a living and this is what I'm trained to do, or I haven't got any qualifications, so I'm stuck doing this, so I don't enjoy it, but I've got to do it. Do you think being able to sort of have fun is a bit of a luxury?
No, we shouldn't. Like, I don't want to go all Mary Poppins, but...
go on,
you know,
Joe,
every job that must be done, there is an element of fun, and I think that's what you need to find. And it is... some people say, you know, you do too much stuff and constantly doing stuff, but I really enjoy it and I absolutely love doing it, and I would hate to be bored. And that's what I don't like, and I like going out and I like doing things, and it's all to do with the people that you're getting involved in and how much passion and enthusiasm you put into each of the projects that you do. You can do what some people see as the most boring job in the world, but if you're excited about it, doing it to the best that you can, that's enjoyable and that's fun.
Do you pass that sort of way of thinking onto your children at school?
Yeah, I like to think that, you know, I'm silly, and I am silly all the time, and I can get, you know, that allowing people to be silly and allowing people to do things because they enjoy it, it's that's what I like to pass on to anybody. That just go and do some silly voices, do something silly, jump around to explain a point, do whatever you like, you know. I lots of people say, well, no, I don't know, I like to make things as big as I possibly can, and I'd much rather aim high and not quite get it than aim low and be satisfied that that's what I've achieved, you know.
Oh,
I want to go for something. I want to make it a massive event. I want to do a big production at Shankland Theatre. I want to do as much as I can. You know, this is the kind of enthusiasm and the energy and the epicness of what I want to do.
Oh, I love that, because you're coming up to Edinburgh with me, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yay! I've got the right man on board.
Edinburgh is my favourite bit of the year, every year. So it's number 7 or whatever it is this year, and it is, like, I need it, because, like, the island theatre scene is good, but I need a little injection of energy and enthusiasm and excitement, and
so this is the Edinburgh Fringe Festival we're talking about in August.
Yeah. And it is like a kind of theatre drug, where you are like, I am watching so many plays in one day and going out and meeting so many exciting people who are passionate and excited about theatre and different types of theatre. You see, I don't know if you saw the TV programme Fleabag. Did you see that?
I've heard about it, but I've not watched it.
That was amazing. That was an Edinburgh Theatre show, Edinburgh Fringe show. It was one woman show transformed into a hit BBC programme.
Wow, really?
You know, you see little magical things like that. You're like, oh, I remember watching this, and the play that goes wrong, that was Peter Pan that goes wrong, that was broadcast on the BBC. That's an Edinburgh Fringe. And you just think, like, these little comedy things that people have set up after uni and have gone, right, let's try this, let's play around with this. And it goes off, and some of them get picked out to be these amazing productions. Some of them are horrendous and terrible.
Of course.
And that's fun. You learn from that, and that's just as exciting.
Because the Fringe is all about anybody who can go up there can go up there. There's no sort of selection process, is there? If you want to put the show on right there, then that's fine, isn't it? That's how it is, yeah. And then you kind of sink or swim. Because it's must have mushroomed even in the 7 years that you've been going up.
Yeah, most definitely. It changes. So there's different... Like now, there's a lot more circus, which is amazing, because it's not like the family circus that we get here on the Isle of Wight. It's really exciting, innovative, well-structured performance, basically, that involves circus skills, and that kind of, a lot of it has a narrative and a story, and the skill level of what they're doing is phenomenal. I absolutely love that, and that's something that circus wasn't really involved in the Fringe before, and has now kind of come into this special circus zones and things like that, which is really exciting. There's a lot more cabaret. I remember the second year I was there was when cabaret was separated in the Fringe booklet as a separate section, and people started really showcasing what's going on there. And that kind of stuff, that it's just different types of things, but the book is always phenomenally large, with thousands and thousands of different acts to go and see, and you're circling through them throughout July to see which ones you want to go and try and get tickets to, and then hearing all the reviews as they come in August to kind of make your decisions of where you're going to go. And you know, I always go and see some of the top ones that everyone's recommending or raving about, and then also go and take a risk on some other things as well. And you just, there's a whole host of mixture of things that you get to see.
Yeah, I hope there'll be people willing to take a risk on. I'm doing 2 shows. That's madness. This is bonkers. Bonkers, as my friend Lynn said the other day. What are you doing that for? You're crazy. You're mad. Yes, thank you. I am. The ones dyed blonde, which is Marilyn Monroe, Ruth Ellis, and that's quite dark. That's their last words reimagined. And the other one is Wit Wisdom and Pratfalls, which works well, woman's Wit Wisdom and Pratfalls, and that's much more sort of based on women and how wonderful and wise and funny we are most of the time. But then those dreadful moments when we want the ground to open up and swallow us because we've put our foot in it. So I think a lot of people kind of can relate to that. So you're going to be there backing me, aren't you, Joe?
Flying. I'm looking forward to it. Yeah, it should be a really good... the Fringe is just such a buzz, and I'm sure you'll absolutely love it. The whole atmosphere and the fact that people are willing to try things and go out and see as much as possible. And I've been up there in many different guises, whether it be technical or flyering, producing. Or, we took a show up a few years ago called Cautionary Tales for Little Boys and Little Girls, which was on at 10 o'clock in the morning, and nobody ever comes to see anything because they're all hungover. It's crazy. But it was... and that was bonkers and really good fun. And it just a few mates prattling around being silly on stage, and absolutely loved it. It was such a good experience. And to be able to say, you know, I've done a show up in Edinburgh, I've gone and seen so many things, and there's just... It is a different world for that month.
Oh yes, fantastic. It is special. It becomes a really special place, doesn't it? Yeah, it's a little bit of magic happens. I remember seeing Steve Coogan there. God, when he won the Perrier.
Oh, yeah. So
we went at the beginning of his career and met him, and he was just lovely, fantastic, and it's, you know, amazing to think was kind of saw him there doing great stuff. And what, you know, I mean, he's a film producer, isn't he, and actor himself, and does amazing and kind of incredible work. And you know, he said he didn't get into RADA, but wow, isn't it? You know, it just didn't do him any harm, did it? He just kind of carried on and believed in himself and thought, fine, I'm going to do it my way.
Yeah,
so he did it as sort of a different route, but came to probably a really good place, well, a brilliant place at the end, didn't he, just as well as anybody who'd been to RADA.
So, yeah, definitely.
So
something
you,
we
Steve.
Always talk about, especially like on the island, but everywhere really, is that you've got to make your own fun and do what you want to do and go out. And the island doesn't, nobody owes you anything, and you're not going to be able to just, like, no one's just going to go, here's a theatre project for you. Now, go out and make your own theatre project and go and do this and go and do amazing stuff. And you'll make loads of... you'll mess up loads on the way, and everybody does, and that's fine.
There's lots.
You just learn from it and move on and make and keep wanting to do what you actually want to do. I've got loads of projects in my head all the time. I know, planned yesterday what I'm going to do at Christmas, and you know, you do all these things, and it's like, that's what's next. There's always like three or four plays that are in my back pocket. If I know that I can cast that one, then I'll shove it on, and all sorts of things. And it's just finding the right time to do the things that you want to do, and seeing whether that challenge is the challenge that you're ready to do right now. There's plays that I really want to do, but I know I probably need to be a little bit older.
Yes. I don't know. That's the challenge, isn't it? And I do think the island's really accepting of spoken word and the arts, and there's a lot of theatre here, isn't there? It's a really good standard, and it's a great testing ground for work as well, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
I don't think people should feel intimidated by sort of checking out some of these venues and thinking, yes, I will put the show on right here, or I will do that poem that I wrote, and just have the confidence to trial it and see what reaction they get.
Yeah, and I'm really interested in moving away from, like, looking at alternative types of theatre and performance and stuff. So this, like, thing I want to do at Christmas is a big cabaret Christmas performance adult pantomime type show, which is completely crazy and something probably that we haven't really had before, but using a whole host of really, really talented people in those fields, shoving them together and making this amazing piece, hopefully, and using a whole, you know, different venues that I've not necessarily worked at, like Fenton Exchange and places in the Key
space.
Arts and all sorts of places that are really fantastic places to heart, you know, has that as a hub for new and exciting work. And I think the island can, if we keep promoting places like the Fenton Exchange and things like that, we can start to have that kind of brand of, like, made on the Isle of Wight, and going off and seeing, actually, look at all this work that people are producing across the country, that they all, you know, the ideas came from things that happened on the Isle of Wight. It would be an amazing place to be.
Yeah. Are you getting involved in the Ventnor Fringe?
The problem is, they always shove it in on August when I'm at Edinburgh. So, but I did go last year for the first time and did some outdoor cinema stuff, and that was Yeah, it's an amazing project.
Yeah, it is.
Really good. They're all people I went to school with, and you know, we're all doing lots of different theatre stuff, which is great.
And that's growing year on year, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. They've got some amazing acts announced this week for the International Festival as well, which, you know, if I have some time, I'll probably try and come back down for. But yeah, loads of great stuff going on event there. And across the island, there's a whole, you know, places, all sorts of things. The Key Arts is so good to see that picking up again, and having lots of different performance styles and acts and artworks that have come from when it's been at rock bottom for the last couple of years. It's great to see it kind of thriving again.
Yes, yeah, it's always, yes, and it deserves to, doesn't it? And it's a wonderful space for anybody who wants to put a production on there. It's fantastic, and there's a lot of backup and support there.
Yeah, it started to be more accessible in terms of costs and all, you know, and this types and different types of performances that they're putting on. That's what's driving and getting more people involved in the venue, because people can go in, whereas before it was a bit like, we're going to put our prices up as high as we possibly can and not let anyone come in, and that's what put so many people off.
Exactly.
But actually now it's accessible and a place that people want to go and trial out things,
because it's not just about putting on the show and being in it and producing, directing. You know, we need an audience.
Yeah.
The audience is absolutely key, or everything just sort of falls flat. So go out and enjoy kind of the stuff. And as Joe was saying earlier, some of it can be hit and miss, but that's the joy of finding the gem for you, isn't it? It may not be everybody's cup of tea, but if you find that thing that you think, oh, I love this, and that's great. Joe, we're all out of time.
Thank you. It's been lovely.
Yeah, it's been
talking
great.
Talking about myself for a while.
Yay! So, it's time to say goodbye. So thank you so much for coming in and sitting on the other side of the desk. It's been a joy to talk to you. Have a lovely Easter.
Thank you.
Okay. And, you all have a lovely Easter too. Enjoy those eggs, enjoy those hot cross buns, and enjoy a little bit of sunshine that I think I can see out there. And, like I say, follow us on Twitter at Vectors Radio and Facebook. So I will be back next week, and I'll be talking to Rob DeBank, so you can listen in on that one again. Okay, take care now. Have a lovely Easter. Speak soon. Thanks again. Bye-bye now. www.vectusradio.com